ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
I'd just like
and energy.
To talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition. Those
two. With Larissa Behrendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
The no vote was a no to changing our constitution, which is a really, really difficult thing to do that people are reluctant to do. What we're doing in South Australia is not changing a federal constitution, but we have legislation that allows for an advisory body to give advice to government. I think as in the years to come, I think, and I'm positive and hopeful that our South Australian voice of parliament will show that there's nothing to fear by allowing Aboriginal people just to have that bit more of a say in the decisions that affect their lives.
An Indigenous voice to Parliament in South Australia and unsettling colonial automobilities, criminalisation and contested sovereignties.
I mean, this is the trap. You know, First Nations people are either targeted for driving dodgy cars or they're targeted because their cars look too good. It's like there's no way you can win in this colonial system.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Behrendt. Kaya Ma was appointed South Australia's Attorney General almost 2 years ago, having been first elected to the Parliament in 2012. As the state's first Aboriginal person to hold the position, his appointment as Attorney General was seen as a landmark moment in Australian politics. He currently holds the portfolio of Minister for Aboriginal Affairs and Minister for Industrial Relations and Public Sector. During his time in office, the South Australian government has made significant progress towards its own version of an Indigenous voice to Parliament, with elections being held earlier this month to determine who will make up the advisory body. Unlike the national proposal, this state-based model would be legislated. But with the majority of South Australians voting against the federal government's proposal, what does this mean for South Australia and its commitment to First Nations recognition? Attorney General Kaya Ma, welcome back to Speaking Out.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Larissa. It's great to be on.
It's been almost 2 years since your appointment as Attorney General, but it's almost 2 years, I noticed, since we've had you on the show. So it's probably a good time to ask you how you've found the role and what have been some of the highlights so far.
Yeah, the role is interesting and challenging, but really, really important. And certainly when I took on the role, there were members of the Aboriginal community who were concerned that, as an Aboriginal person and as Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, whether Attorney General was a good fit. Given it's the laws of the state and the colony that have done so much to disadvantage Aboriginal people over the last couple of centuries. But, I took the view that that's exactly why you need a person who is fighting for the rights of Aboriginal people in a role like Attorney General. It is a really unique role in that you sort of have a bit of oversight over a lot of what government does as Attorney General, and it's the legal advisor to Cabinet, to Parliament. You can make a difference, and some of the little things that I think have been really important have been legislating for the Noongar Court, the Aboriginal Sentencing Court in South Australia, that's been operating since 1998, but it's never been enshrined in legislation. So, making those small changes have been really pleasing, and I think have been a worthwhile thing to do in the role.
When you look at your reform agenda going forward, what are some of the things that you're hoping to achieve, at least within the rest of this term?
Yeah, I guess one of the really big things that we're looking at this term, and we are in the middle of at the moment, is our, as you said in your intro, First Nations voice to Parliament. Having that elected, which will happen in over the next month, and then bedding that in over the next 2 years, I think will be really, really important. There are other things that we're doing as well, reforms that we're looking at. For example, we've just put out a discussion paper on raising the minimum age of criminal responsibility in South Australia that touches on both my Attorney General and Aboriginal Affairs portfolio. So these are significant reforms that a couple of other jurisdictions have tackled that we're really interested in seeing where we can get to and land with those as well.
Might just dig down into the voice to Parliament, because obviously that is a huge step. And I just wonder, from your perspective, how did you interpret the outcome of the referendum nationally?
We saw opinion polls published that had extraordinarily strong support initially. And as the campaign wore on, that dwindled. I was exceptionally disappointed, I think, in some of the statements were made during that campaign from those advocating a no vote. It reflected that, you know, fear trumps hope in a lot of occasions, and also the fact that we just don't change our constitution. I think this is what, about the 37th or 38th time out of 45 attempts that we voted no to changing our constitution. So, yeah, although it's disappointing more than anything else, it just shows how reluctant we are as a country to make changes.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine anyone's going to have the political appetite to take that on again anytime soon. But from your perspective, that decisive no nationally, how has that played out for Indigenous issues more broadly?
There's no doubt it's difficult. I think one of the things that we saw during the campaign that has lingered since is that, you know, for people who have views that don't support Aboriginal people, they are more willing and feel they have a license to express those. And I think that's really difficult for the Aboriginal community. For people who've dedicated their lives to, you know, bettering their Aboriginal community, yeah, it's been a difficult blow for their life's work as well. But for a lot of people, it's raised issues, put them, you know, just shone a spotlight on the disadvantage so many Aboriginal people face. And has really galvanised, I think, a new generation of Aboriginal activists, which, you know, if there is a bright spot from the referendum, that is certainly one of them.
Of course, one of the implications of the referendum was both in Victoria and Queensland, bipartisan support was lost for their treaty and truth-telling processes. How has this played out in South Australia, and how are you strategising around the fact that there was such a strong no vote in the state, but you are still progressing this agenda?
Yeah, I've been asked this a number of times, and the no vote was a no to changing our constitution, which is a really, really difficult thing to do that people are reluctant to do. What we're doing in South Australia is, you know, not changing a federal constitution, but we have legislation that allows for an advisory body to give advice to government. I think as in the years to come, I think, and I'm positive and hopeful, that our South Australian voice of parliament will show that there's nothing to fear by allowing Aboriginal people just to have that bit more of a say in the decisions that affect their lives. So I'm hoping and I'm confident that what we're doing here in South Australia will perhaps show the way and maybe make it easier for other governments around Australia to do something similar to what we're doing.
I was going to ask you this question. You sort of prompted me with looking at this as a kind of nationwide phenomenon. I mentioned earlier that you were appointed into the role as a First Nations person, but when you sit nationally with Attorneys General, there are other First Nations people at the table now. What difference do you think that's making at the national level to some of the issues that are really crucial to First Nations people? I'm thinking of things like raising the age of criminal responsibility.
I think it's extraordinarily helpful. I've had that when we all meet as all the Attorneys General from around Australia, Selena Yubo from the Northern Territory, and now holding that role in Northern Territory, Chauncey Paik. It is really, really useful to have the views of Aboriginal people, a couple of Attorneys General now around the table when you're discussing things that have such a dramatic impact on Aboriginal people, Aboriginal populations in the justice system. So, I think it's a really useful thing to do, and I'm looking forward to more Aboriginal people becoming Attorneys General in states and territories in the future.
It does seem like such a phenomenal thing. I think back to when I was at law school, we didn't even have... we had such a period where there were no First Nations people in federal parliament, very few in state parliament, to actually have a period where we've got so many First Nations people representing us through both state, territory and federal government seems to have been quite a step forward.
Yeah, it is a step forward. And just some of the, I talked about this, the Noongar Sentencing Court that we've enshrined in legislation. Only in the last year as well, there were two Aboriginal women appointed magistrates in South Australia. This is the very first time in the history of South Australia and the colony that came before that we've had an Aboriginal person presiding over one of our courts. So being able to make these small changes does add up and make, I think, can fundamentally change the fabric of who we are as a society in South Australia and with other Attorneys General like Chauncey in Australia as well.
I imagine that's one of the real benefits of having the start of what could almost be a critical mass, but there must be additional burdens that you carry as a First Nations person in the Attorney General's position. Obviously, the increasing rates of Aboriginal people in the criminal justice system or the over-representation indicates a whole range of continuing issues that First Nations people have with the criminal justice system. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, how do you balance the fact that you have responsibility as Attorney General, but in a way, the community also holds you responsible for the role?
Yeah, it's not always an easy thing to balance, but it's not something that I or others are unaccustomed to. I spent a few years when Jay Weatherill was Premier South Australia in the mid-2010s as Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, and there was always that as an Aboriginal person holding that portfolio, I guess a sense of expectation. You bring a level of understanding that's really beneficial, but there is that legitimate expectation with what you will do in that position. And I think that it's even more highlighted with the role of Attorney General. But yeah, I think that's only a good thing, that there is expectation that we do better for Aboriginal people in South Australia.
You've mentioned your family in previous conversations we've had. What role do they play in keeping you strong but also on the straight and narrow?
Yeah, we've talked about that previously, and my late mother was a pretty influential person in my sort of shaping my views of the world and growing up in Mount Gambier. She was a NAIDOC Lifetime Achievement Award winner. She was herself involved with the local branch of the Labor Party, so that intersection of Aboriginal affairs policy and politics certainly following very, very strongly in what my mother did during her life in her work.
It's not an easy path for First Nations people. I sort of feel it's a bit like being a lawyer, where you're part of a system that primarily works against the interests of our people. But there's lots of First Nations people like yourself who take it on. And I think of Linda Burney when she was in state parliament in New South Wales and she took on the portfolio that had child protection and how difficult that was for her. When you went into politics, though, you must have had a view about what you would hope to achieve by taking that difficult role, challenging role within the system. When you look back, do you think you've been able to achieve what you'd set out to try and achieve?
Yeah, I think so, Larissa. It's maybe not so much setting out, achieving what I set out to achieve, but when I look back, I'm grateful for the opportunity and pleased at where we are now. I spent some time as a lawyer in the Crown Solicitor's Office in Adelaide after finishing uni. Then I had 4 years as the Chief of Staff to the then Aboriginal Affairs Minister from 2002 to 2006, and it was during that time that I decided the way I wanted to make a difference, particularly to my Aboriginal community, wasn't as a practicing lawyer, but in policy work, and decided early on, if ever there's an opportunity, that's what I want to do. If it ever came up to be Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, I'm not sure. I'm trying to think. I can't remember thinking, these are the certain things I'd like to achieve, but certainly looking back at my time, it's as Minister for Aboriginal Affairs in two governments and a term as Shadow Minister, it's probably 8 or 9 years now holding the portfolio for the Labor Party in South Australia. I think I look back and can say with some pride that we have achieved, I think, good things in South Australia. We've got the First Nations voice to our parliament being elected. We started treaty negotiations way back in 2016 that were put on hold when one term of a Liberal government was elected, but they will restart in South Australia. We had a Stolen Generations reparation scheme, the first mainland state to do so in 2015. So I don't remember setting those things as targets, ambitions or goals, but looking back, I'm proud of what we've been able to achieve.
You have, as you mentioned, had a period earlier on in your career where you were in the ministry as Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, but you held a couple of other portfolios as well. And then you spent time on the opposition side of state government. How did that shape you when you came back into government? Did it mean you had a stronger sense of what you wanted to achieve? I guess I'm interested in what lessons you learnt from that earlier time and then sitting on the opposite side watching the government do things that you would have done differently.
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. It sort of sharpens your focus in a couple of ways, Larissa. I think it reminds you, having time in opposition, just how precious almost every day is when you're in government. You know, every day you're in government and you finish that day, you're a day closer to not being there and making changes that you want to make. But it also, on a couple of different levels, reminds you just how important government is. And these are things, individual people's lives. I will get representations from Aboriginal people about things that they need help with, just how much more you can do from government to help people, but how much more you can do collectively to change the direction of policy in the state. So, I don't wish for it again, but a term in opposition, I think, helped with that direction and reminding of what's important.
You mentioned the treaty process had been on hold and you're coming back to it, and I'll ask you about that in a minute. But I guess I just wanted to get a sense from you. You've now, in a way, restarted the process by looking at representation in a representative body. What are you hoping, or what are you sure that that representative structure will provide and bring to decision making around Indigenous issues?
I am absolutely certain, and there's evidence from around the world that demonstrates that involving the people for whom you're making decisions in the decision-making processes will create better decisions. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And I'm sure that will happen in a whole range of areas: education, health services to Aboriginal people, child protection. In my area, in the justice system, we will, as a government, make better decisions. And it's not just involving Aboriginal people who can, under our legislation, partake in cabinet meetings a few times a year, can speak in Parliament on legislation. But I think it'll have the effect of focusing all of us, our departments and the members of Parliament and members of Cabinet, to consider the impact it has on Aboriginal people as we're coming up with those decisions, knowing that we're going to be held more accountable. So I think it'll have that dual purpose of actually having that voice to hold us to account to make better decisions, but making us more conscious as we're making those decisions of the impact it has on Aboriginal people, families and communities in the design of what we do, knowing that there's that accountability mechanism.
It's a great segue back to ask you what your ambitions or your plans are for a treaty process going forward. And of course, with the Uluru Statement, we talk about representational voice, we talk about treaty, and we talk about truth, and other states have truth-telling processes. Is there a part of your agenda that includes that truth-telling component as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It was from our time in opposition that we talked about before. Way back in 2019, it was our very first policy we came out with from opposition during NAIDOC Week in 2019, was a commitment that if we were to be elected, we'd implement a state-based response to the Uluru Statement, voice, treaty, truth. And we will use the elected members of our voice to help give us some advice about how we restart the treaty process. Certainly from when we started and the first ones to start way back in 2016, a lot has happened in the treaty space. Victoria very well developed with their First Peoples Assembly. Queensland have treaty-enabling legislation and are well-developed in their processes. There's been a report from a treaty commissioner in the NT, and New South Wales are looking at how they go about it. So, we will restart that process, but the landscape has changed pretty dramatically, and we're keen to get some views from through our voice, but also look at what other jurisdictions are now done in South Australia to the difficult process of retrofitting a treaty process to something that didn't happen a couple of centuries ago.
With such a full agenda and a pretty difficult one when you consider a lot of the First Nations issues that fall within your portfolio as Attorney General as well as Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, how do you ensure that you stay connected with community with such a busy life? What ability do you have to reconnect with country?
It's combining some of the things that I love to do with my work. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity on the far west coast of South Australia, out past Ceduna, to take the swags out and go to homelands, meet with community leaders, but then be able to roll out swags and sleep on the beach. And whether it be the APY lands or down in the southeast, I love getting out on country, rolling a swag out and just having a couple of days where combining both my work with just being on country and in community. So, in Ceduna, for instance, after camping out, I had an hour to spare before getting on a plane. So, got my shorts on, and with a whole lot of the Aboriginal kids jumped off the jetty in Ceduna for an hour or so. So, just doing those things, help re-energise you and make it all worthwhile.
The other thing I was going to ask you, just finally, in relation to how you must manage the stress of an incredibly stressful job, and I was going to ask you, what songs do you play to rid yourself of the stress of a hard day?
Yeah, music like Zachariah Fielding and Electric Fields is on pretty high rotation. Other Australian and US country music gets a fair workout. Mainly, I'd say, and it's to the great detriment of all of my staff who have to come on long road trips with me, but almost exclusively country music or Thelma Plum or Zachariah Fielding, Aboriginal Australian music.
And do you have a particular song that you would choose at karaoke?
I rarely, rarely do karaoke, Larissa, but if I had to, if there was no other option, it would probably be Garth Brooks' Friends in Low Places.
Ah, excellent. What an excellent choice. Well, hopefully next time you come back on, you might do a little performance for us.
I can guarantee there's no prospect at all of that.
But thank you so much for sharing time with us, especially in the incredibly busy, stressful work that you do. I hope that you'll continue to come back and share with us on Speaking Out the reforms that you're doing and what you're seeing on the ground in South Australia.
Can't wait.
That's Attorney General of South Australia and Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, Kyan Maher.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABCRN, Radio Australia on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. Coming up, a new book is exploring the role of automobiles in imposing colonialism on First Nations people and communities. You'll hear from the authors Thalia Anthony and Juanita Sherwood shortly. But first, some music from Troy Cassadaly.
Take a step away from the daily grind, come and get a little sunshine. If you want to feel wild and free, take a walk in my country. Lose a little time on an endless beach, footprints behind you. Cast your troubles in the deep blue sea and take a walk in my country. Come away. Spinifex planes, gentle voices will guide you. Get a little red dirt all over your feet and take a walk in my country. Come away on eagle's wings. Come away, yeah, where the dreamtime sings. Brothers and sisters, take a walk in my country. Country, come away on eagle's wings. Come away, yeah, where the dreamtime sings. Brothers and sisters,
That's country music legend Troy Cassadaley. The song is called Take a Walk in My Country, and it was released back in 2015 on his album Freedom Ride.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
A new book examines the role of automobiles in imposing colonialism on Indigenous people and communities. The work is based on extensive research of First Nations people and communities around the world and explores how Indigenous people are often disproportionately criminalised for non-compliance with vehicle regulations, the vehicle as a tool of racial violence, and how Indigenous communities use vehicles for protection, cultural expression, and reconnection with their land. It's a fascinating subject and a comprehensive body of work. Juanita Sherwood is the Professor of Australian Indigenous Education at the University of Technology, Sydney. Her expertise ranges across Indigenous research, First Nations health, cultural safety, birthing on country, and Aboriginal women's incarceration. Thalia Anthony is a Professor of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney. Her work has focused heavily on the legacy of colonisation and systemic racism in legal institutions. Thalia and Juanita, welcome back to Speaking Out.
Thank you.
Well, we're here to talk about a new book that you've co-authored, Unsettling Colonial Automobility's Criminalisation and Contested Sovereignties. It does sound very academic in the title. So, Thalia, I wonder if you could start by giving us a bit of an overview about what the concept of colonial automobilities is.
Yeah, I might just tell you how it started. And Larissa, you'll know about this. Like, at the time of the intervention, I was doing some work up at Lajimanu, and there was this sense with the intervention that they were going to go and find all this crime about Aboriginal child abuse and family violence. And I was sitting in the court just on when I had some time off looking at the stolen wages issue and just noticing the criminalisation of Aboriginal drivers. It was like they wanted to control Aboriginal people's movement. They wanted to let them know that the police would not enable them to be free in Aboriginal communities. And this idea of the automobile being controlled was really quite fascinating to me because I'm in Lajimanu looking at the criminalisation of Aboriginal drivers in their car, and I'm also looking at night patrols, this kind of manifestation of sovereignty and self-determination, Aboriginal people using their vehicles for strength in community. And so I was like, this idea that we criminalise Aboriginal people in their car is part of the colonial system. You know, you can't drive and be free as an Aboriginal person. And then, and Juanita might talk more about this, cars are also colonial because the police use cars to chase Aboriginal people. And so, again, you know, you can't be free. It's like wherever you are, it's a moving checkpoint. And that's why we see the car and colonisation is built into the same framework.
I have to say that when I saw the title, I thought, wow, what's this about? But as you break it down, just as you've done it, it actually becomes a very coherent argument. And I want to get into some of those particular issues that you have addressed there in a bit more detail to reflect some of the things you discuss in the book. But just before we do, Juanita, I wonder if you could also talk about what your motivation was to undertake this body of work and your experiences that led you to want to write in this space.
Well, I think, you know, a very lived experience, really, of observing the way police have interacted with our communities in Redfern, in Alice Springs, in far north Queensland, in Broken Hill. I've lived in all of those places and I've witnessed the criminalisation of our people around fines, you know, broken windows, you know, having a windscreen just cracked for ridiculous reasons, and people being fined and then incarcerated. And I've done a lot of work with women who've been incarcerated over the last 15 years, and I just think the criminalisation of our people and how, exactly as Thalia said, the intervention just even further exacerbated the belief that police could control all of us in all ways, on all things. And the criminality of that space, you know, flipping it, it's really critical to look at and examine that space. And I guess my just remembering, you know, my first day in Alice Springs as I moved up there, I witnessed a big white Jeep trying to run down an Aboriginal family at the Kmart car park. And I just went, oh, my God, what have I come to? And, you know, that was after my days of working, in Redfern on Everleigh Street. So, yes, I was very driven and pulled to work in this space.
Thalia, you mentioned that one of the sparks for the idea in this space was sitting in a court and watching that criminalisation of drivers. I wonder if you can explain in a little bit more detail for people who would have no idea what it's like in those courtrooms, what you were seeing and how people are criminalised as drivers in that process.
Yeah, so people who are driving in community are really low-hanging fruit for the police. They can pull over someone, as they routinely do, and charge them for a huge range of things. It might be something like a defected vehicle, because so many of the vehicles sold in communities are sold in a really shoddy way by dodgy dealers coming into communities and ripping them off. It could be an unregistered vehicle because there's no mechanics in communities to actually provide registration slips, and then there's no registration services. It could be unlicensed driving. It could be uninsured vehicle. There's all these things, and police, rather than saying, okay, how do we, you know, provide licensing, or how do we actually ensure that there's a registration process, they simply put on a fine, they disqualify the driver and set them up into this cycle where they can never drive lawfully. And so you have them piling people into the criminal courts, the bush courts, and they feel that there's this pressure to just plead guilty, to get it over and done with. And that might be okay the first, second, third time, but like Juanita said, eventually we have people sitting in prison because they don't have access to services for their vehicle. They can't afford to get, you know, well-maintained vehicles and buy vehicles that are from reputable salespeople. And they're penalised by being in prison. So when we were looking at the proportion of people in prison in the Northern Territory a few years ago, it was 25% of people, one quarter of people in prison. So 90% of people in Northern Territory prisons are Aboriginal because of the systemic racism there. And a quarter of those are there for driving. And it's all just so unnecessary. And it has huge consequences for community. You know, they're taken, the only prisons in the Northern Territory are Darwin and Alice Springs. They're taken out of their remote communities. They can't care for their kids. They can't learn culture. They can't pass on culture. So it's not only stopping them from driving, it's stopping them from being part of the continuation of their community and culture.
Juanita, another issue that you look at in the book is the issue of missing Aboriginal women and girls. Can you talk a bit about why that was a topic that made its way into the book?
Because, I mean, this is an area that has been talked about in Canada. It's also been talked about in New Zealand. And, you know, it's definitely an issue here and it's hidden. And this book, if anything, is trying to demonstrate and be a truth teller around what is going on to our women in Australia. As First Nation women, they're treated appallingly. We know, again, through the intervention, you know, our young women were targeted by truck drivers, etc., in a whole lot of unhealthy, or, you know, approaches to their sexuality, etc. And I think we have many, many women who have been killed and murdered in this space that we don't have their bodies to show those spaces.
Yeah, and I think what happens, and this is for men as well, that there's a lot of deaths on highways, yeah. You know, where it's, you know, a remote part of the country, there's no accountability. Invariably, it's a racialised, sexualised issue that targets First Nations women, but we've also had other cases of missing First Nations young men. So I think that what happens is that these lands that were once including highways along the songlines of Aboriginal people. They're appropriated, you know, by colonisers and turned into highways that then make this space where they were once empowered a space where they're incredibly vulnerable and where the legal system doesn't properly investigate to provide justice for these families. And that's why we've got, you know, inquiries today where we're still looking for answers for First Nations people whose lives were taken decades ago on highways.
You both touched on this role that police cars play in the death of First Nations people when you were talking about why you were drawn to writing in this space and wanting to explore the issues. Thalia, can you give us some more examples of the kind of instances you look at?
Yeah, and the police chase is an ongoing issue. We've just had the death of Jai Wright referred to the DPP, and that was also a police chase a couple of years ago. So even though we give some examples that are a bit more historical, and we start with TJ Hickey, who was killed in Redfern in 2004, it's a police chase where not only was there huge tragic injustice in how he was killed, which was impaled outside a housing commission estate in Waterloo, but it was also a case of tragic injustice in what followed. And the officers responsible never gave evidence. The bike that TJ was riding in the chase was never presented to the coroner. No one knows what happened to it. And we've just had the 20th anniversary of TJ's passing, and still the family do not have any answers of what happened. They also can't even have an official plaque where he died because the police don't want to take responsibility. And I think this idea that, which is part of why we wrote the book, that, you know, police chases are just a normal part of police duties. And even the Royal Commission in 1991 into Aboriginal deaths in custody didn't examine the police chase. That since then we do count deaths in police chase in official statistics. But it's only recently that we've started to say, no, it's not routine police activity. It's actually a deadly chase that is targeted at First Nations people. And then more recently, we have the case of Raymond Knoll in Victoria, where the police targeted him, which is so common, for driving a dodgy car. And immediately they put on the sirens. They're driving at 134 kilometres an hour, and within seconds he's dead. And I feel like, you know, the way the coroners respond is the car got out of control, as if it's a mistake rather than... I mean, this is the trap. You know, First Nations people are either targeted for driving dodgy cars, or they're targeted because their cars look too good. It's like there's no way you can win in this colonial system. And I feel like this is the, you know, this is the racism embedded in, you know, the policing of First Nations drivers.
Juanita, you also mentioned when we were talking about what drew you to this topic that while there is a whole section in the book where you look at the role of policing and police cars, that actually non-Indigenous drivers are also part of this equation.
Yes.
Can you give us a bit of an overview about some of the issues you look at there?
Basically, non-Indigenous people feel that they have the authority, like the police, you know, that they can take up and imprison and penalise and injure our people. And there is this ongoing colonial way of doing business. And I just couldn't believe what I saw this morning. I went, oh, my goodness, what year are we living in? 2024, and we've got these non-Indigenous people thinking that they can take up their own power and enact it against our people. And that power is, you know, with we talk about a Kumanjay rider who was killed in Alice Springs in the riverbank, chased down by five non-Aboriginal men who felt it necessary to teach him a lesson and kill him, and evaded being evaded paying any retribution for that. and their imprisonment was minimal. And having lived in the territory, that I saw the belief system and of this is okay, you know. And because people are not charged and are not criminalised, people feel they can get away with this.
Thalia, it becomes apparent looking at this space that there is a situation that we see in other aspects of the criminal justice system where you see First Nations people overrepresented as victims of crime, but also over-policed for minor offences. What are your observations about that in this space?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of your work represents this as well, Larissa. This idea that, you know, they're so heavily policed when the police want to punish them, when they want to control their lives, the new Aboriginal protectors. And yet when a First Nations person dies on the roads at the hands of either, you know, a white settler or the police, the investigations are really inadequate. There's absolutely racism in both the investigations and the prosecutions. I think that with the Aboriginal people who die as pedestrians, the attitude at least, and I've been on Talkback Radio in Darwin, the attitude of the people calling in is that they're the problem. They're putting themselves in a dangerous situation. And like Juanita was saying, and we saw this also with Elijah Doherty in Kalgoorlie, when, you know, in the very rare instance that a settler or a police officer is charged, what happens is that the sentencing is so sympathetic with the offender. So if you look at the sentencing remarks for Elijah Doherty's perpetrator, he's seen as a good guy who had a good job, who had a family and responsibilities. There's nothing in those sentencing remarks that really paint a picture of Elijah and his important role in his family, his culture and his community. And I think the failure of the legal system to humanise Aboriginal people, including those who die on the roads, and in Elijah's case, I'd say it was a very calculated killing. Their lives are just are diminished to really give justice to the harmfulness of the crime.
Juanita, what are you hoping that the impact of this book will be? And in particular, I'm interested in what sort of legal and policy reforms you'd like to see.
I think really it's a truth-telling, and, you know, we need to be more involved in the truth-telling of what's going on today. And this book bears witness to a lot of really important stories, and it contextualises those stories very well. And I think it's about providing evidence that this is not nonsense. This is not, you know, myth-making. It's backed up with a great deal of evidence. And, you know, after the referendum of last year, where we had a lot of people creating a lot of myths, we've come out with a text that is, you know, the truth. And it is vital. It is a vital component to what where we are seeing the criminal justice system work around our community. And for our youth in particular, a big concern of mine is that their experiences in the justice system undermine their opportunities to ever be educated. You know, they are put into a system where, you know, the education is not even considered, and they're missing out on being, you know, able to capture what every other child in this country has laid out for them. And I feel that that criminalisation is just further impoverishment of our people. And when they are in the system, the poor treatment continues. So I want to see improved. I'd like to see that our people don't go to prison for car fines, etc. And also, there should be funding made available for our communities to access driving tests and get regos, etc. New Zealand's doing a lot of really good work like this in North and South Island, and there's an opportunity for us to likewise do similar programs. And because driving a car can provide a really good income to a family and a community. So there's we could flip this and make driving and the use of cars and our community love cars to build further opportunities for employment, et cetera.
And what about you, Thalia? Are there particular reforms and impacts you'd like to see as a result of this work?
Yeah, I mean, the listeners here can't see the cover of the book, but the cover is quite graphic. It's a police car burning. It's a mural that Scott Marsh produced in COVID following the killing of George Floyd, which then reinvigorated calls by First Nations people for justice. And one of those calls was from TJ's family. So he did a burning police car to illustrate the resistance against the police and their imposition on First Nations people on the roads, especially poor young TJ. And I think that's what I would want to see, less targeting of police cars of Aboriginal mob. I'd like to see more strength and empowerment for night patrols in Aboriginal communities and let community take care of their own safety, because their safety would look a lot better than guns and police in community. And I think if we take away the police vehicle, we're taking away a lot of the power of the police to follow and chase Aboriginal people and mobs. So I'm not saying that this is just about changing, say, the colonial legal system. I think it's also about shifting our focus to how the vehicle can be used to protect mob and to, when Anita said, to further opportunities and to further their capacity to even do things like use the vehicle to freely go out on country, you know, to take kids on country and do stuff that really reconnects them with country rather than, you know, vehicles being used to incarcerate mob.
Another issue that you've both worked on that I just wanted to pick up on is the transition of First Nations women from prison. Juanita, you did mention that when you were talking about your work background and some of the things that you've focused on in the past, but you've both worked in this space. Yeah. And I wondered, Juanita, if you could just tell us some of the issues that you see facing First Nations women when they are released back into the community.
Interestingly, yes, I can definitely talk to this. And I'm currently on a project called Bangamalana, and I've been interviewing women who've been in prison and exiting prison around. They get no healthcare provision inside. Ideally, it's believed that they're looked after from a health perspective, but that's, you know, they can wait 2 months to see someone in the health workforce in prison. And generally, people get put on a lot of medication to calm people down. And I spoke to a young woman who put on 42 kilos in 2 years during her imprisonment because of the dodgy food that people get fed. And we know diabetes is, you know, a critical issue in our communities. And in fact, prison diet and lack of health provision creates that. And women leaving prison and men are at really high risk of committing crimes within the first week. They're released without any money. They're released without clean clothes. They may have an outfit organised for them through Dressed for Success, but for a lot of people who have been on remand, that doesn't happen. And if they've got soiled clothes, they just have to walk out in the greens. There's no housing support. There's no referrals for medical health. And I'm really worried about that because a lot of people get put on, as they should, a medication for mental health issues. And when you're released, you're given maybe 4 or 5 days worth of medication. It can take 2 months, 3 months to get in to see a medical psychiatric being to provide you with another script. So what do you do in the meantime? These people are put at greater risk, if anything. So we're doing a double injury and double harm to people being released into a community that has no housing support for them. And we know the housing's a big issue for everybody, but, you know, triply for our men and women leaving the prison. And generally, they have no options for, you know, finding a place to live and build up their ability to be recognised as a good tenant, etc. They've probably been thrown into prison without being able to tell housing that that's what's happened. And so they've got a, you know, a bad reference around them. So there's just so much that damage that occurs just by being put in prison for a month or two.
And Thalia, from your perspective, you worked in this space too. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so when we spoke with Aboriginal women in prison, one of the stories that really stood out was at a prison down on the south coast where an Aboriginal mother was driving her child who had high needs and was going to an appointment for a disability service, and she got pulled up by the police. She was charged with driving-related offences relating to registration and licensing. She's then arrested, denied bail. When I saw her, she'd been inside for 4 months, still waiting for a hearing, and her children had been taken into care. Mm. So she, in that time, had lost her home, lost her job, lost her freedom and lost her children, all because of driving charges. And I really was confronted by that. I asked her, how do you keep going? Like, it's too much. It's too unfair. And her response was the only thing giving her strength with the other Aboriginal women in prison. I still feel really emotional because frivolous it is to put Aboriginal women in prison who have so many important roles in order to deal with a problem that is one of servicing and poverty. If women had access to proper vehicles, to, you know, proper services, there would be an ability for them to drive lawfully. But the system sets them up that it's almost impossible for them to comply with all these rules. And rather than assist them, they're criminalised and they lose so much in that process. So what we really suggest in the book is that there are better ways to do this. And part of the amazing initiatives include like out at Yuendumu, where the Aboriginal community set up a mechanic and they have the children doing mechanic apprentices at Mount Theo. So there's ways in which Aboriginal people can and have been empowered to drive in a way that is lawful and safe, but the system just deals with them through a way that creates more harm and doesn't address the problem, which is one of, I think, Aboriginal people not having the capacity to freely move on their country.
Well, thank you so much for all the work you've done in this really interesting and complex space. And thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to stop by, speaking out and talk about it.
Thank you very much for having us.
That's Professor of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney, Thalia Anthony, and Juanita Sherwood, who is Professor of Indigenous Education at the Jumbana Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney. Their new book, Unsettling Colonial Automobilities, Criminalisation and Contested Sovereignties, is available now. That's the show for now. Join us again next time when we explore the issue of domestic violence in Indigenous communities. Speaking Out is produced by Jay McAllister and Sarah Allerley. You can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.